and welcome to the Nattercast for our Borgias and Game of Thrones double cast. We're covering the season premiere of Borgias, the Borgia Bull, and the second episode of season two of the Game of Thrones, The Nightlands. And as always, I am Jason Schenkel of Schenkel Studios, here with my lovely wife,
Sione Schenkel.
Sione Schenkel of Schenkel Studios. And unless there's any business for this week, we covered a lot of business last week, so I figure we can just jump in this week on stuff. And so I want to start with Borgias, because I figure we did Game of Thrones last week. We can just go sort of go boy, girl on these episodes. So this is the second season of Borgias, and we both, this is, they call these Wikipedia dramas on the net. These are like these historical dramas like The Tudors and things like that, that they say that the premium channels, you know, could have done all their research on Wikipedia for the drama that they create. And we have the return of Jeremy Irons as Pope Alexander. You know, this utterly
perfect casting
and just this utterly, like, completely shamelessly hypocritical Pope, who's like sleeping with people and having them murdered and getting revenge, but then moralizing at all of his cardinals who are equally corrupt and, you know, saying we are the superior thing. I just love Jeremy Irons so much. I've loved him since the 80s, and so it's great to see him in this. And his daughter Lucretia and his sons Cesare and Juan and all of their activities. Do you have anything to say about, like, the first season of Borgias? How did it kind of got to you, or no? Or
I just really loved it. I think watching it in tandem with Game of Thrones is interesting, because I think they're really similar shows.
Yeah, yeah.
Except for the Borgias is based a little bit more on historical fact.
Yeah, but you have, like, the incest, and you have the brotherly competition.
You've got cross-dressing, you've got
incest, girls playing boys.
You've got, you know, torture, you've got different kingdoms, you know, people being placed in different kingdoms for different reasons and fighting for their spots in different
Absolutely.
Kingdoms and cities. Yeah.
And it's great with Game of Thrones, because the War of the Roses was one of the big sources for Game of Thrones, you know, and this isn't the same exact period, but it's like that kind of intrigue, that kind of European courtly intrigue is what we're dealing with on both shows. And so we think it goes pretty well together. All right, jumping right in. So we start off with Borgias, with the altar boy drowning, attempting to poison the Cardinal Della Rosa. And Cesare is supposed to murder the Cardinal. He's supposed to have the Cardinal murdered, and he hires an altar boy to do it. And it looks like in the beginning, like, he spills some of the poison and it's not enough. It doesn't actually kill him, but it paralyzes his tongue or silences him or something like that. And so that's good enough for Cesare, you know. And then later on, we have the Pope meets with his two sons and says, "We are going to restore Rome like a family." And he's got this whole thing.
Well, he's pretty mad at this.
He says, you know,
fighting, infighting.
Della Rosa still lives, you know, and Cesare's like, "Well, he's quiet. You know, we got what we wanted out of it." And Juan says to him, "You need some lessons in killing. You know, like, I might show you how to kill people." It's kind of like Juan's threat on that. And then the altar boy, though, this is like the first 5 minutes of the episode. This is where I knew we were going to enjoy this season. So the altar boy's out by the well talking to one of, I guess, Cesare's henchmen.
He just decides to just drown him.
Well, I guess he must have been under orders.
That's a lesson in killing.
Yeah, altar boys.
Or exercise in killing.
So that's our body count so far, is one altar boy down, you know, and one cardinal, you know, compromised, like, in the opening scene. You know, then this is where it's like the Borgias are back, you know, is what that felt like. And then we have, speaking of Borgias are back, so then we have the Pope is in his bathhouse with his latest mistress, who he's having sex with, while his I guess primary mistress Julia is out of town.
Yes,
you were saying a guy this old even today is going to have trouble.
Three days of
with this much action, let alone.
It depends on what kind of action he's getting. I mean, there's a lot of different activities you can do in the bedroom.
I guess so. This is 500 years ago, man. He didn't have hardly any options on getting it up. So he's doing it.
Maybe he just
well.
Likes lots and lots of rubbing.
Could be lots of rubbing involved. Yeah, that could be. Yeah. Who knows? Well, we were saying before, it's like you take a pretty huge risk with venereal disease in this environment. So
that's true.
You might want to do a lot of frottage, you know, to keep yourself healthy. And we learned that Julie Famese, who's the primary, basically his wife, but he's not allowed to be married. You know, he's the primary mistress is returning. And so he's, like, hustling her out the room, and she's like, you know, like, "Hey, I was promised some payment." It's like, "Okay, here it is now. Get your ass out of here." You know? And so it's like, and then he's got he visits Lucretia, and she has her baby, right? And so that places this in 1500, 1499 to 1500, right around there. You know, I did my own little Wikipedia research, and I found that the big popastic thing that happened in 1500 was the War of the Turks against Venice. So it looks like the Turks are going to be invading Venice, maybe not this season, but like soon in the life of this of these characters. And the Pope takes about a year to get behind Naples and the rest of the free Roman or free Italian cities to fend off the Turks, you know. So that looks like that's going to be the big military thing, but they don't set any of that up yet, you know. And he's got the child, and he's visiting, and the French ambassador's here. And
oh, like, I'd love the little child thing.
He's got the little kid.
Because it's it just, to me, I was watching it, and I was going, because it's his whole, you know, I'm the Holy Father metaphor. Watch me, and this is what's important to me, and yeah.
It's like, well, and then he says, the French ambassador's here. Isn't he dead yet? It's like, I'm so over the French ambassador.
Yeah, well, it really hammers it, you know, because he talks to his sons about getting it together, and he's just so into family, even though he plays Big Love.
He plays Big Love, and he plays he plays his kids off against each other, but he's very family-oriented. He sees family as the strength.
Well, I think he sees it as his army.
He sees it as the only
Everything's his army.
The only people, I hate to say use the word trust, but it's the only people he feels he can rely on. Like, he knows well enough that he knows what positions to put them in and that they won't, you know, they won't act unexpectedly. If, even if they betray him, he'll be expecting it, I guess is kind of his idea. The other thing, though, that he's saying now, excuse me, this year that we're hearing for the first time, is that he wants to restore the glory of Rome, like the old pagan glory of Rome, right? And he plans this big, like, Burning Man Roman, you know, festival, and the cardinals are like, are you sure that like a big pagan bull burning festival is going to be okay with, you know, with our Christian values? He's like, oh, if you knew your history, you'd know that Easter was celebrated long before the death of the Savior, you know? And he's like got this idea that he's going to restore like the emperorship of Rome and make the Pope like the emperor of the Roman Empire. And that's kind of, that's a tall order. That's a big, you know, stroke for the Pope to take. Okay. Oh, and then and when he's got the, he's talking to his daughter, right? And he says he's insisting that she use a wet nurse because he figures it's too.
He wants her figure.
He wants her figure, and you
which
were...
ironically, it's proven that if you breastfeed, that's how you'll get your figure back the fastest.
Maybe they didn't know that, or maybe he was referring to a fertility. It's hard to tell.
It does. It brings down your fertility too when you breastfeed.
Right.
But yeah, women who breastfeed get those waistlines. Some of them get even better shape than they were before.
You're processing a lot of nutrients.
Well, also, yeah, and well, it's complex, but you also get rid of thigh fat and all kinds of stuff.
And then she says, you know, I can't help but notice I'm still of marriageable age, and if it was convenient, you would marry me to the moon. And he says, why? Does the sun now threaten our papacy? That's like a perfect Irons moment. It's like, you watch that, you don't like that moment, you're not going to like Jeremy Irons, you know, basically. And we get a couple more details. We learned that Alfonso is at large. We get this from the French ambassador. Alfonso was the, I don't know if king is the right word. He was the, I guess he was the king of Naples, who got deposed and replaced with the French king, Charles, last season. And everyone's looking for Alfonso. He purposefully poisoned his own city with the plague, right? So this guy is like a stone psychopath. And he's about to run into a couple of other stone psychopaths, I guess. Let's see. Then we have the meeting with the brothers, and, the Pope says, "Vengeance shall be ours," which is like the exact thing that the head of the Christian Church is not supposed to say. It's like if there's a list of things that like a Christian leader isn't supposed to say, "Give me some vengeance" is gonna be it's got to be way up there.
I don't know, because "Vengeance is mine," saith the Lord.
Exactly, not
the Pope. Lord is full of really.
Right, but he says
in the Bible, that character has every human emotion times 20,000, all the negative ones.
Well, certainly in the original trilogy. The later films, he loosened up a little bit. But he says this is mine as opposed to yours, as the context of vengeance, it's mine. You know, he's trying to tell humans not to take vengeance on each other. And already, you know, the Pope is saying, well, you know, we're going to get some vengeance. Then we have a little sword fight between the brothers and a little horse race, you know, with the... at the pagan thing. And I guess it was it Cesare? I forget which one. One of them cheated. Cesare cheated and threw down caltrops in front of the horse and wiped him out. Now, that's an interesting horse stunt to see after all the trouble they've been having with luck. You know, because we see some horseplay in Game of Thrones as well. I'm wondering if they're going to be as sanguine about using animals and stunts like that going forward. If, for anybody who doesn't know, they had this series, I think it was on Showtime.
Mm-hmm.
We saw the pilot.
Yeah, Michael Mann.
Very
Mann
promising.
Series.
Michael Mann, some great horse racing segments. And, David Milch writing, his Shakespearean style was great. It was short on women, but it felt like that could be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of got into it, like, oh, I'm ready to kind of watch this show. And then they had like two or three horses die, in filming. And people were saying the problem is they were using real racehorses. They were not using stunt horses. They weren't using horses that were used to starting and stopping and resetting and all this kind of stuff. And that they just, had a problem with that. So hopefully we're not going to see any horse problems on any of these other shows as we go. Then the Pope is with his lady friend, and they're going hunting, and he sees a doe, and he chases it through this little wooded area, and it's like he's playing Skyrim with his lady. And they find these Roman frescoes, and they're like...
Oh, that was like when we went to Ostia.
Wasn't it?
It really reminded me of when we were in Ostia a couple of years ago.
I forget if we've told people about Ostia.
We've told a lot of people. I don't know if we told
people. On the Natter. So we went to... I've always been a big Roman guy. I love, like I said, I love Claudius, and I studied Latin in school and everything. And I just sort of am somebody who identifies with the Roman Empire. And so I wanted to go to Rome before I was 40. And so for my 40th birthday, we went to Rome. And I had kind of an itinerary planned out for the city. I'd looked into all the places you're supposed to go. And it's actually not that big of an area. Like ancient Rome, the ancient Roman city is kind of like three or four large college campuses in size. And we ran through the trip, and then there was this one outlying thing, which was to go see Ostia Antica, which was the old
port
of Rome. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like,
we'll just
40
take the ride
miles
out.
Away, 25 miles away, something like that. Train ride.
I think
ride.
Like 20 miles, 25.
Yeah, 25. And you take a little train ride.
It was very much like taking BART from San Francisco to Walnut Creek.
Right, right. Or going to New Jersey from New York or something.
Yeah,
or something
it's pretty
like
simple.
That. Yeah, something like that. And so we just kind of trundled out there because we figured we'd kind of run out of things.
I wanted to see the Mediterranean. You hadn't seen it.
I hadn't seen the Mediterranean.
I figured it'd be a couple of piers that were kind of broken down in some tourist traps.
I was saying like a dock with a rock
nothing
with a plaque.
Oh my!
If you're ever in Italy,
it was the highlight of our trip.
It was the best thing,
Hardly anyone was there.
It's like a mile long stretch
of ruins,
perfectly
with
preserved
flowers,
ruins.
And you can touch the frescoes. And you're walking through an entire city.
And it's like 1,500 years worth of history. It's like house upon
and you go
house
for blocks
house,
with that before you see
ruin.
Another human being.
Yeah, and you don't see other people.
And there was an incredible museum there.
Yeah, and it's quiet, and there's a
and it's a short
museum.
Walk from the train station. It
yeah,
was
right over
just
a bridge.
Incredible.
And and so discovering these frescoes, it kind of reminded us of that moment of like discovering Ostia.
It was like, ooh.
It's like, ooh, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And so that's what gives him the idea for this big bacchanalia that he wants to throw, this big bull burning.
Yeah, he wants to go pagan because that gives people joy. Pagan equals joy.
Well, so we're saying this is joy. We need joy in ancient Rome and emperors.
So he goes burning bull.
He goes burning bull.
Basically, instead of burning man, you have burning bull.
Yeah.
Exactly. You have the same... Everything except for the electricity.
Well, what I love about it, too, is the cardinals were complaining.
You got the dust.
They were complaining about the expense. And that didn't look like... He's like, oh, we'll have a costumed ball. And we'll have all this. And I'm like...
Horse races.
Didn't look
chariot
that expensive
races.
To me. They're like, oh, my God, how are we going to afford this? It's like, you have a twine bull.
Wicker, I think.
Or wicker or whatever it is, yeah.
Vines.
And a ball. A masked ball party.
Well, he was wanting to feed everyone in the city.
Bread and circuses. But he's figured it out from the Romans, man. The way he's got to keep this together, the way he's going to keep this together is by getting the loyalty of the people.
Yeah, he wanted to pull a Caesar.
Yeah, he wants to pull a Caesar. He realizes that this whole papal idea of just holding on to the loyalty of your cardinals, that's your left hand. Your right hand is the people. He's mm-hmm. very much become a man of the people here because he's realized he can't count on the church.
Well, also in the first season, near the end, he pulled that incredible stunt where when the... when the city was under siege,
mm-hmm.
That he decided to dress very plainly.
Right.
All the cardinals left.
Yes, when France was coming in on Rome.
Right.
Yeah.
And the cardinals all fled, and he put on like, a gunny sack thing.
Right.
And prostrated himself in like,
I am. And was found praying.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that it was the opposite of what everybody was assuming was this incredibly decadent, inappropriate, the worst
right.
person possible to be Pope.
And he ended up with an ally.
And it was very smart. Yes.
Yeah, the king is now his ally.
Yes. And then he gives, which now his, what, he gives that king.
He gives him Naples.
Yeah. Which is another part of our
podcast. We're going to get into that in a second. and it was a very smart move on his part, because he knew that if the King of France wanted him dead, he was dead no matter what.
Right.
So if you're going to kill me, you're going to kill me, and the story's going to be you found me in plain clothes praying and holding up the honor of the church.
Right, and not retreating.
But it's, you know that it's totally calculated. You know mm-hmm. that he's saying the honor of the church is the only thing I got in my pocket. I'm mm-hmm. not going to give it up. You know, once I don't have that, I'm dead. And so he's got this fantastic way of playing this honorable guy where it's completely self-serving, right? Where it's like, every time I'm invoking my honor, it's a strategy, but I'm actually doing it very well, you know? And that's always fun to watch with him. Let's see what else we have here. And then we have, Cesare and Lucretia. She's named her, or she's talking about her child. She's thinking of calling him Narcissus, you know, after, and she tells Cesare, I found this interesting. She tells Cesare, there's one person you have to learn how to love before you can love anybody else, and that's yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of our modern
yes.
psychological values. But it mm-hmm. became a value in the 20th century. It's not something that people always believed. Self-love was not always admired. So it's interesting to see Lucretia Borgia, who's got this reputation of being this highly corrupt woman.
Very vain.
Very vain, mm-hmm. and somebody who we're not supposed to admire, articulating something that we would actually say is a core value today, you mm-hmm. know, is that self-love is an important thing, you know. I don't know if they're doing that to make her sympathetic or just to make us kind of feel ambiguous.
Or when her character starts to develop more, yeah. we'll think of her as a narcissist.
Yeah, well, certainly the character of narcissism. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. As in modern-day narcissistic personality disorder.
Right.
When
right.
you're crossed, you hit people and
exactly.
stuff.
Exactly. Smacking people around. Let's see. And... then we have King Charles. He's in Naples, and he's basically looking for Alfonso. And I guess we can jump forward a little bit here. So Alfonso appears, right? And first of all, I gotta say, I mean, I thought Lord Joffrey is a pretty unlikable character, but Alfonso is probably one of the least appealing characters on television. He's got that voice.
Mm-hmm.
He's got that cartoon villain voice.
Yes.
That fool de Montague. You know,
like, no, Warren de Montague has a much nicer voice.
Warren has a much nicer voice, but if Warren was playing this part, he might
take this voice
on. It's very nasal.
It's affected.
Yeah, it's pretentious, yeah. Yes. And he's just nasty.
He's whiny.
And he, like, they're hunting him down with these dogs. What were those dogs? They were the Mastiffs.
Neapolitan Mastiffs.
Neapolitan Mastiffs, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a dog I've considered getting.
Yeah. Are they good hunt dogs? Are they person hunting dogs, as far as you know?
Yes.
Evidently, you can find Alfonso.
They're a dog of war.
Dog of war. Yeah, that makes sense.
They're a working breed.
Yes.
And they have really saggy skin, so if they're attacked, they can wiggle free.
They attack them, yeah.
And they don't, or if they get bit, they can take down lions, they can take down horses.
They looked pretty, they were small, but fierce looking.
No, not small.
Smaller than a bull mastiff.
No.
No? Maybe I was just looking at some of the perspective.
Same or bigger.
Bigger. Same or bigger? Okay.
They're smaller than a mastiff.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's what I'm thinking of. Yeah, they did. I've seen mastiffs that these didn't appear to be like the size of a pony. You know, so I've seen a lot of mastiff looking dogs that are pretty huge. These seem more like pit bull size, like large pit bulls.
Well, I had a bull mastiff, and yeah. She was 115, 120 pounds.
These might have been.
She was a little taller than average. Yeah. They easily, yeah.
So they find Alfonso, and then the. So the French King Charles, and they say, oh, one of the reports we get from Cesare is that Charles has the Neapolitan disease.
Right.
Which is syphilis.
Right.
So they have him being cupped.
Yeah, and the cupping was, it was like, yeah.
Tell us, what is that cupping?
Well,
I've seen that.
Well, what's interesting with the cupping is it's a Chinese medicine technique.
Is it?
As far as I know. I mean, that's my understanding. And so I was kind of surprised to see it used in Italy. But then this was after Marco Polo.
This was after Marco Polo.
So then that would make sense.
Yeah.
Because I know that it was used later, I believe. Now I'm going to get my history all messed up. I want to say medieval times, but late. It was
post-Renaissance.
Yeah, post-Renaissance. More Elizabethan.
Like the 70s, 80s.
It's part of the leeches, the bloodletting, all
right.
those
Well,
those
you also see
things.
Dangerous liaisons,
mm-hmm.
which is going to be like the 1700s.
And still today, if you go to one of these acupuncture...
They cup you?
They'll cup you.
And it didn't look friendly.
It's basically what it does is it's pretty uncomfortable
mm-hmm.
and painful because sometimes they'll move them around, but they'll leave the
Oy.
Suction. And the suction's really intense, so
the
you
heat,
feel like your skin is separated from your muscle.
Yeah.
So what it does is it releases endorphins, and that's what makes you think your pain is going away. And they take them off, and you're, oh, my foot feels better. Well, yeah, because you're high off endorphins. It didn't do anything. But they'll say, oh, it's taking out the evil spirits, or, you know, whatever.
Well, there's some evidence, like, from
woo-woo stuff.
Acupuncture. That acupuncture is the same thing. It basically releases endorphins, yeah, and dopamine. But that can cause swelling to go down, because, yeah, your tension goes down and other things.
Well, also, you're sitting there, you're getting pet and massaged.
Yeah,
and
it's psychological.
It's a quiet space, and they listen to your problems, and that's what the real magic is.
And then
is.
They put a flaming hot tube on you.
I have a cupping set if you'd like me to do you, honey.
We'll talk about it later. So then Charles, so he's like, he's being cupped, and he's you know, wants Alfonso, and then they capture Alfonso. They bring him to this dinner, and Charles starts fucking with him. He's like, oh, I can't eat. I'm taken ill, but you go right ahead. And, you know, tell me about your city. This is such a nice place. And
it was such a great setup.
He was really good. I like this actor too. This big, like, mm-hmm, French Gallic, just totally.
He's got all these prostitutes all, like, scantily clad hanging all over him. I'm like,
he's got
two
just to push him around.
Want to get near him physically if he's that? He just seems like a big bag of pus.
He's like a big barrel-y bag of pus. Yes.
Yeah.
He is the king, though. It's good to be the king. Yeah. They always say.
And he was just given
Naples.
Right.
And he's like, well, it's such a shame that, you know, so many, you know, Neapolitans had to die, you know. And he's like, oh, they're, you know, people, they breed like rabbits. They'll be back. And it's like, he doesn't care that, like, 10, 20,000 people.
Yeah, this guy's complete sociopath.
Total sociopath, right?
Yeah.
And so Charles says, well, maybe you can give us a tour of your city. So
it's like, oh, take him out of his handcuffs. Feed him from my plate.
Oh, take him out of his handcuffs. Yes. And feed him off my plate. It's just
totally.
Just.
Oh, yeah.
That was so nice. And he's like, perhaps we could start. And he's like, I'd love to give you a tour of the city.
Yes.
It's like, let's start with your father's torture chambers. And this is when the guy knows
something's up.
Oh, I'm fucked. Yeah.
Yes.
You know. And then.
And here we go.
I'm skipping through. I'm going to come back and cover the Bacchanalia, because I want to get to the torture thing. It's just been pleasing me so much. So they take Alfonso down there, and he's under arms. And they have him. They're presenting the various torture devices. And the last season, Alfonso had this. And then we saw it again in this episode. He had this tableau set up of the Last Supper, with his dead rivals, apparently well-preserved enough that you could just pop.
That's been going on. They had that the whole other season, too. He taxidermies anyone he...
Yeah, it's been a year, though. I'm saying they must have taxidermied or embalmed or drained him of blood, at least, or something. You know?
Oh, man.
It must have been nasty.
Still,
there were flies in
there,
man. It wasn't, it wasn't completely preserved.
Oh.
And Charles notices that the seat for Judas is empty. There's no seat for Judas in this tableau. So he says, I'd like to see Alfonso in that seat. I'd like to have him complete this seat, you know. And so they go on the tour of the torture chamber, right? And the first thing we see is a torture device called Judas Cradle.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see Charles go, ah, Judas Cradle is
exactly.
You know, it's funny you mentioned Judas.
And the way a Judas Cradle works, this is where Sione has a little expertise in the macabre. And torture devices, is that it is triangular. Sometimes that was kind of a pyramid.
It's a pyramid.
That's going to actually work a lot faster than some of the ones I've seen.
The wedges.
Some of the one I've seen are just a wedge that's long, like a faux riding horse, like, mm-hmm, that you put a saddle on. And instead of being round, it's triangular shaped. And that can take easily a week or more to die.
Oh, yeah.
So what they do, but the Judas Cradle would go a lot faster, less than a week. So then after that, they show you the anal probe expands with fresh blood on it.
Well, he mentions that it can be oral or anal.
Right.
It works for both sets of orifices.
Yes.
And there's like fresh blood on it.
Yes.
And then, you can use it to expand.
Yes.
And expanding the mouth would be almost worse than expanding the...
Well, I don't know, because the mouth, it depends on the device. The mouth and the anus, actually, this is a medical fact, have the same amount of nerve endings and are made from the exact same tissue.
Yeah.
That's one reason why a lot of people like analingus, as the same as kissing, because it's a similar amount of nerves that are being stimulated. And they're basically just ends of the same tube, digestive tube.
Yeah, it's one big tract.
Yeah. So what becomes very interesting... And they're both kind of dirty, too. The human mouth is pretty dirty. So what's kind of interesting is that what he shows them, the Judas Cradle, and it's the pyramid shape. And what happens is you're sat on that.
Yeah.
And if you're just sat on that, even with some clothes on, and you're strapped to it so that you cannot get off. Slowly what will happen is your blood will start to, your, like, your, and your arteries and your legs will start to close off.
Pull up and embolize.
Yeah, exactly. And it just very, it's a slow impaling, and it's excruciating, and it goes on for days.
Yeah. While you can't get comfortable, it's like crucifixion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what will slowly happen is then your internal organs start to crush. It's just,
it's nasty.
Things start to snap and spread, and it's just the most, one of the most horrible ways to die, because it's so incredibly slow. So my guess is that they doubled up on those two toys.
So that you think they hit him in the mouth with the expander and then put him on the put him on the cross for the other, for his, his rear area.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking that too, except for we heard him screaming.
That would do it.
But he, if his mouth was blocked, we would have heard some.
No, that didn't block. If you notice it, it spread open.
I know, but it would still sound like there's something. It wouldn't, because
you, I don't think so, because the way it, way I was looking at it, or they could have opened him up a little bit to make first, sitting him on the cradle a little bit more interesting. You're definitely gonna have to put a disclaimer on this show that this one's extra full of extra action.
Extra action. Well, if you're watching the Borgias, you've seen the action.
Yeah, it's practically. What is it? It's not R-rated. That's got to be at least NC-17, pushing a triple X.
Seriously.
Because the sex alone.
So we love that.
Yeah.
And then the last little bit on the let's see here. The last little bit of the story is the apprentice, who's a girl dressed as a boy. So we have this theme also in common with Game of Thrones, where Arya is all, Arya doesn't really disguise herself as a boy, but she's often confused for as a boy and doesn't say anything about it. In this case, there's a an artist's apprentice who wants to learn how to be an artist, and girls can't do that, so she's pretending to be a boy, and she's got this wig, and then under her this wig, she has this beautifully treated hair that just falls over her shoulders when people pull the wig away.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, she would have, that would have been cut off. She wouldn't be wearing a wig.
No, you'd think you'd cut it short, you know, just because it's hard enough to maintain because that anyway.
It would
you're
just
trying to be a boy.
All that hair would keep the would pop the wig off.
And who's
especially if you start to sweat or try to run fast.
And who's it
or
for?
Brushed up against someone.
Yeah.
Well, she's trying to have a job that would only be a male would only be allowed.
That's true.
To have.
But so why have gorgeous hair? There's
even, yeah, just cut it off.
Yeah. And so the Pope puts the moves on her at first, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then realizes that he says, you are more Eve than Adam. Like, okay, more Eve than Adam. And then
he's all sleazy.
Yeah, he's all sleazy. And then Julia figures it out. I think it was Julia, Mrs. Pope. And she like has this, there's this whole like sapphic come on thing where it's like, your bull looks like a cow.
Well
you know, there's all
well,
this
what it was is that who was it was speaking to her and talked about the
I think it was Julia Femesa.
The two faces of Janus.
Two faces of Janus. Well, that's at the ball.
Yes, at the ball.
Yes.
That's and after that at the that's when she comes on to the young painter.
Yes.
Because at the ball she gets this, you know, she's concerned about losing her place because she figures out
Right.
He's out in the hallway at midnight, even though there was, and she also sees the red stocking that was left by the woman that was ushered out.
So she puts
that on, hoping he'll see.
Yeah, that she's going to be Jake.
She's
with
got
this.
Well,
yeah.
She's got a red stocking and her own white stocking.
Right.
And then after that, she goes to the ball, or I think, and then she gets the lecture from her friend. If you're going to, you know, retain control of the situation, you need to accept that Janus has two faces.
Yeah.
God Janus, and just make sure that you are. You are one of the people, of the two people that Janus gazes on.
Make sure that his gaze lands on you.
Right.
Was the idea.
Make so sure that's what she does is she takes his gaze and she goes right up to the girl and kisses her right in front of him.
Yes.
So now she's in control of both of his gazes.
Little girl's gone wild action just to keep control of the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that, and this is all very Roman, you know, sexual stuff, you know. Let's see here. Got the tranny artist. You're more Eve than Adam. Oh, and her name is Victorio or Victoria. I'm like, really? Victor Victoria?
Yes, you were laughing so hard, Victor Victoria.
It's just so great. You know, I love it. And then we also got, right before this sequence, we got the title reference, the Borgia bull. This is the bull that Victor Victoria was painting and that the Pope had a model of. And it's Isis's bull. And the Pope says, well, Isis was the model for the Virgin Mary. I mean, where he gets this stuff, I have no idea. He's just making stuff up. Right? Oh, yeah, sure. Isis, you know, who was a goddess and not human and all this other stuff. She was just like the Virgin Mary. Okay, fine, whatever. We'll call it that. Let's see. Then you have Burning Man at Rome. And how much does Joy cost? It costs about $250,000. I forget what the money was, but $250,000. And it just didn't seem like $250,000 thing. But if he's feeding everybody, I mean, it's either that or they're not going to eat, you know. So it's not clear to me that you can save money by not feeding people under these circumstances. And then we have the mask ball and things looking both ways, and then the Judas cradle. And let Janice look both ways, and then we're kind of out. Yeah, so definitely, I think, got me. I liked it better than what I saw last season. I really liked last season.
Mm. Well, you know, it's one of my favorite shows.
Yeah, I felt like
for some reason, I just get so darkly interested in it.
It's really dark, and I thought the production values were up.
Yes.
Nicely.
Yes.
And I really like I just love Jeremy Irons so much, and he just seems to be having so much joy with this role. He's just really taking it on, you know, really greatly. All right, rolling back over to Game of Thrones. This is episode 202 of Game of Thrones, called The Nightlands. And The Nightlands is a reference to the afterlife of the Dothraki people, you know, when their warriors die, they go to the Nightlands. And so this starts off with Arya over by the stream, making some water in the stream, taking a little whizzy. And then some of the Team Lannister's people come looking for Gendry, who's on the run with this same group. And the guy who's kind of like in charge of moving this you know, passel forward, like, threatens to nick his femoral artery, I guess, in his leg. And he says, and there's nobody here who knows how to unnick that, you know. And I liked this scene because it kind of highlights how, you know, what one of the elements of drama on this show is you have this authority. You can send out your guys to go hunting or whatever, and people have their loyalties, but ultimately people are going to be loyal to the people who are right around them and take care of them, because you have this, like, still very wild and untamed planet that they're on, right? And so you're going to find these camps, and they're not going to just turn Gendry over. These are all a bunch of criminals. They can't count on being paid by royal people anyway. They're going to keep their mouth shut. And sort of the, like, the don't snitch thing seems to have been played up here. It's like nobody is snitch. Gendry can count on nobody snitching him out, because it's just not part of what they would do. You know, they'd rather kill an Imperial Guard, I guess. And then we have Tyrion and Shay. And Shay is talking to the eunuch, right? And you know, Tyrion is kind of upset. He says, you know, don't threaten me. I'm not Ned, you know, Stark. I know how to play this game, and you don't come here and threaten me, I'll have you thrown into the sea. And then the guy says, well, you might be disappointed by the result of that, because I can swim, is his, you know. And then all the subtext here is like, you know, if you think you can cut me loose or throw me to the wolves or whatever, I'm going to pop back up to the surface, is what the eunuch is saying. And Tyrion is saying, I'm not the last hand of the king. I'm not the guy that you can play a little bit and betray and then get executed. I'm going to be able to outmaneuver you.
He's quite the strategist.
Right, but we've set up this conflict with the eunuch, right? Because the eunuch, you know, he's like warning the eunuch. It's like, I'm not Ned Stark. You're not going to be able to do this to me. He's quite the strategist, but he's also quite the perceiver of people, right? He's just like, I know what you're doing. You're manipulating people in my immediate surroundings. Don't threaten me with revealing anything. Don't threaten this. You know, I'm gonna cut all that off from the beginning. And then we have the small council. They're considering Rob's demands, and they're basically sort of like worried that these mystical creatures are going to rise up. We got the White Walkers and all this other stuff, you know, and Tyrion. And then Cersei says, oh, you come back from the north and you're believing in, you know, grubs and shubs and all these, like, mystical creatures. It's like, well, no, I kind of saw some stuff.
Yeah.
you know, it's not just when there really is a zombie apocalypse going on, you can kind of start believing in zombies, right? Let's see. And then we're at the wife camp, you know, and you know, we have one of the daughter wives is kind of enthralled with the dark.
Oh, this is, I mean, I would imagine most women that watch this are just, that was completely creepy.
Right. It's so creepy. Well, but then this one guy, the Night Watch guy, kind of like the
oh, he's so sweet.
The little sweet little chubby guy. He's like, well, we could take her with us and we could save her.
He's like a wistful, listening to the story about his friend who, the other soon-to-be monk or is monka. Yeah. oh yeah, I grew up on a farm and there was this milkmaid and we used to always, you know, get it on after wrestled as kids and we got it on. He's like, he goes like this, oh, I wish I grew up on a farm.
Well, that's these really guys are so hard up. One of the other podcasts I listened to, these guys pointed out, these guys are so hard up that they're up here and these women, you know, when they're in their winter clothes, they don't look like women. They look like just blobby humans like everybody else. And one of them turns around, like walks off with some task or whatever. And the other guy's like, oh, I love watching women walk away. It's like,
The other thing is, I think I prefer watching them walk towards me.
Yes. Well, first of all, I like watching them walk towards
me. Okay, so maybe he's into a humiliation fetish.
I guess so, but it's like, but it's all, no meaning I like to watch the badoinka doink. You know, I like to see it.
Ass.
But you can't see any ass. Because she's covered in furs, like she's a walking, maybe she's like a walking couch at this point, you know. And so, but it's believable. It's not unbelievable because it's like these guys are hard up. These snow watch guys don't see women for like years at a time. You know, you'd be pretty excited by this too. And so, but the other guy says, look, don't steal a wife. And this reminded me of one of our little jokes. Wherever we go anywhere, I always say to you, don't steal a baby.
Right.
I want to make it clear that Sion is under no threat of actually stealing a baby.
Oh, sometimes I am.
Well, you can admit that if you
want. And it has to do more with, I think that there's something going wrong in that situation.
Don't steal a baby.
Well, sometimes it's older children, and I just think that some people don't deserve them. If I see a really smart one who's being ignored.
We're on vacation. I'm going to the corner store for some talcum powder. I want you to stay in the hotel room, and I don't want you to steal a baby.
Anyway.
So this guy says, don't steal a wife. And the other guy's like, well, you can't really steal her because people aren't property. You know, she could just come with us. She's free to do what she wants, you know. And they establish in this, I guess, that there is no slavery in Westeros. It's not a practice of Westeros to own people directly, evidently. So that was kind of leaked in by this. It's like, you know, he was like alarmed at the idea that one person could own another.
Right.
Right. So that's been established.
But it's so crazy. I mean, this guy is...
Big love?
Boinking, yeah. He's big, disgusting love. Because at least it's consensual with other big love stuff. But, you know, consensual, I have no problem with polygamy. But
big love born.
Well, what he's doing is he's marrying a young woman, getting her pregnant. When she has a daughter, I don't know when he starts his activities, but the daughters he's going to fuck later, the boys he sends out, you know, to be
killed, starved, or whatever. How many generations could he possibly have been doing this for?
It looks like it's been going on for a while, but that is just like beyond, that is a perversion. That's like listening to these stories where a woman is kept or a girl is kidnapped and kept it, you know.
Oh yeah. Like what was that in Germany?
And also here up in Northern California.
Fritzl with his basement, you know, and then you have the neighbors are always like, oh, I don't know. We heard some banging one time, but I don't know what's going on over there. It's like, there's a giant fucking dungeon in this house with people trapped in a basement who never get away, you know? So it's pretty twisted up there at Camp Big Love. Then we have Team Targaryen, and Team Targaryen sent out some scouts last episode, and now a horse returns with a scout's head in it, so it's pretty clear that wherever they scouted to is not going to be welcome territory. And there's like blubbering, you know, and we can't burn his body and all this kind of like, you know, what are we going to do kind of stuff with the wife. And we're really starting to see Daenerys Targaryen, like, you know, be the leader of her people, but she's in a desperate situation here. She's got no resources. They have no food. They have no water. They have no friendlies. They have no place to go. They are heading away from where they want to be, but only because it's the least dangerous path for them, and it's already deadly, you know. So I think it seems like, you know, as somebody who hasn't read the books, that they're going to be keeping her isolated for quite a while here. You know, I keep seeing her as not yet part of the main story. It's like this is a parallel thread, and she's going to come in at this like right at a crucial moment and make herself known to people. She's not going to be a factor in their lives until she shows up with dragons, you know.
Well, she's going on a total hero's quest.
Yes, very much so. She's developing, you know, like.
So is our little needle.
Arya.
Yes.
Stabby. Arya Stark.
Miss Needle.
Well, Arya at least has brothers, and she's going to her home. You know, she has a safe place. She has friendly people. You know, all she has to do is get there, right? And let's see. Oh, so then we have Greyjoy at sea with his little friend, the Comfort Girl. And he's like bragging about how he's...
So nasty.
So nasty.
Well, I'm like, I was just cringing. She's so desperate to leave. And I'm like, he's treating you like his sock.
Well, she kind of is. She's just a...
A sock.
A sock, totally. Ugh. But she's asking him
masturbation sock.
He thinks he's going
to
be the
king. But there's an expo. They use it for a chance to do something very salacious and get some expos. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's describing to her how, you know, he's going to come riding in town. Everything's going to be great. He's going to get the Greyjoys to sign up with the Starks. They're going to go after the Lannisters. He's going to be the hero, you know? And then at the same time with this, like, sex, that we have the sex in the Pillow House, which was starting to get to be just basically straight up porn. We saw some like heavy ass moving, some heavy fellatio. Just the sex is getting a little
on both shows.
This one's a lot more explicit, though.
You think so?
We haven't seen any humping on the Borges just here. We've seen post humping,
okay,
and some nudity, you know, and some grabbery. But here we're seeing flat out humping in like every episode, you know. And then we have this long kind of expository dialogue, which I am led to understand is not from the book, between Littlefinger and the madam, who's not a character in the books either, where he's like he's talking about what other men are capable of and what he's had to do to manipulate people and this kind of thing. And it seemed kind of awkward. It seems like he's really spending a lot of time micromanaging the brothels that he runs when he's supposed to be in charge of the money for the government, you know? And it just feels like, is this really a huge part of the economy?
I think he's really enjoying himself.
I think he's enjoying himself, yeah.
I mean, he gets to play, you know, tyrannical prince.
Yeah, yeah. And then we have Tyrion is meeting with, I didn't have his name down here, but he's meeting with a lord who basically is the one who betrayed Stark, you know. And, you know, the head of the City Watch, basically, who's become a lord now. And he implies that, you know, it's like, well, you know, Ned Stark couldn't buy you because you were already bought, is what he said. And the guy says, are you questioning my honor? And he says, no, I'm not questioning your honor. I'm denying that it exists.
Yes.
You know, and it's just that was... And so he has this guy hauled off and to go join the Night Watch. So he's sending him up north, you know, to maybe probably spy on the Starks a little bit, but also just to get him out of King's Landing. And his basic thing is... you know, look, you were in charge of the City Watch and you betrayed the last Hand of the King and got him executed. There's absolutely no way I'm trusting you, right? And then Tyrion replaces him with his friend, you know, is this mercenary, and asks him, now if I ordered you to kill a baby, you know, would you do it without question? And the guy says, no, not without question. I'd ask you how much.
How much, yes.
But in this moment, again, this is where I'm just going to have to worship Peter Dinklage. I mean, such a great actor. The look on his face gave you such a mixed reaction.
You know, his acting is
acting is beautiful.
He's quickly becoming probably one of the top 10 actors in the world.
Oh, right? I think so too. I think he's certainly the best actor on the show, and the show's got good acting.
Yes,
you know, and he's the top.
He's doing a huge range.
Yes, like later on Cersei says, you know, you killed our mother. Mm-hmm. Right? I think it was last episode.
It was my mother too, and you all of a sudden just like sentimentality,
and I never got to meet her.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Unlike you. But in this one, where it's like, okay, I've just replaced the City Watch guy with somebody else who will kill a baby. I'm realizing that the baby killing thing is going to be a problem for us because we're off massacring, you know, bastard children. And as soon as winter comes and people are starving, they'll use that as an excuse to cut all of our throats. And here's this guy. I've just replaced one corrupt City Watchman who was disloyal to his, you know, to his lord, with another one whose loyalty to me is based entirely on money, right? And you can see that he realizes he doesn't have the friends here. He doesn't have the power here that he needs to have to do what he needs to do because his sister is irrational and his nephew is insane, right? And so, so that the look of sort of horror and, you know, acceptance on his face in that scene, that was my favorite shot of the episode. Oh, and then we have Arya back at her camp, and she's having a debate. This room again reminded me of something like you might describe happening in your childhood. These two guys, and they're washing clothes and pots and stuff, and they're saying, "Well, I've seen a battle. We haven't seen a battle." Well, it's like, "I saw two men fighting outside of a bar." And it's like, "That's not a battle." It's like, "Yes, it was. They were wearing armor. That means they were knights. It must have been a battle." Yeah. And then I think it's one of the Stark guys says, it was Gendry. Gendry says, you know, wearing armor doesn't make you a knight. And they're like, well, how do you know? He's like, because I sold plenty of armor, you know, to complete fools who were not knights who would get into drunken brawls outside of a bar. And then I think it was Gendry also says to Arya, says, you shouldn't insult people who are bigger than you. And she said, well, then I would never be able to insult anybody. You know, which would be, of course, a problem for her. I've got to insult someone. Everyone's bigger than me. Let's see. What else do we have here? Oh, so Greyjoy. So, man, this was, I think this is my favorite SmackDown so far on a show that has had plenty of SmackDowns. So he gets off the ship and he's not greeted by a huge parade. You know, that he's expecting like to arrive like it's, you know, VE Day or something like that. Like just the you know, ticker tape parade and all this kind of stuff. He gets one, you know, he gets this like woman shows up and says, you know, okay, I'm here to take you up to the castle. Now on the online, people were saying that she was not very attractive. I thought she was cute. You know, when he, remember he arrives at the dock and there's the woman there and they go riding off and he's like, why don't you take me to your bedroom tonight? And she's like, you can tell your grandchildren about it, you know, and she's blonde and
I think kind of what happens is that you see these like over the top beauties and you when you watch TV or film, you kind of, people switch.
Yeah.
And they start, and then if anybody looks outside of that over the top beauty, they're like, they have the same.
You have to look like Michelle Pfeiffer.
Well, they have the same molds for the women and the same molds for the men. If you look outside of that, then you're a character actor or you can't be a leader or sexually interesting.
Right.
And then people offline who all are 30 times less attractive commercially than the person they're criticizing go off on it. And you're sitting there going,
Well, it's not so much it's off so as weird. They were like, you know, evidently she's described in the book as being more beautiful or something, or comparing. And you're right. She doesn't look like, she doesn't have like the movie star good looks that like Cersei has or any of these other, or Melisandre or whatever.
Right.
But she does look like the kind of tough chick who would be a fighter and still be beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, it's like she's not homely. She's just, you know, kind of. She's not glammed out. She has this great little smile, man. This is totally like a chick I would have gone for in high school. She's like, I'm with her. Anyway, so she's like fucking around with him. And then he comes up to the king. And the king is like, you know, this is the guy's father, Greyjoy's father. And he says, did you pay the gold price or the iron price for that insignia you're wearing? Meaning, did you buy it at a market or did you win it in battle? And he has to admit that it was gold. And his father takes it right off of him and tells him in no uncertain terms. Greyjoy is here to negotiate for ships for the Stark fleet, you know, for attacking Great. You can't attack King's Landing without ships, right? And it's like, he's not going to get ships out of this thing. And on top of that, you're a complete disappointment and you were raised by the enemy and just, you haven't, you know, proven yourself to me and your sister has. And then that's when we get the big reveal that this is his sister.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, again with the incest.
Mm-hmm.
George R.R. Martin, he loves him some incest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could argue about it in the Borgias, but at least that's historical. Here, this is, you're making this up. Every brother and sister couple that you create has to have some kind of sexual tension. Is that the case? Don't people meet each other online anymore? You think you have to stick with the family, I guess, George? And let's see what else we have. Then back over at Team Baratheon, we have the introduction. Now, again, so here's an issue I want to raise. This has been mentioned in the onlines as well. Racism in fantasy in general. There's this general idea that black characters are characters with dark skin in kind of Tolkien.
Well, this isn't just fantasy. This is Shakespeare.
This is
theater throughout the ages.
Yes, but that's throughout the ages. This is modern stuff, so we feel more
It's still part of it.
I totally understand that.
You still
that.
See it in film and TV, and I mean, it's not as bad, but it's still...
I don't think it's as bad in what I've seen of Martin as it is like in Tolkien. In Tolkien, every character with dark skin is evil.
Right.
Right.
Well,
period.
It's often that the dark hair on a woman makes her the bad woman, the blonde is the good woman.
Right.
And then there's the gray-haired crone, and it's just like not a whole lot
But we've introduced our first black character. Mm-hmm. Here on the show. So this is the first guy. He must be from some other nation that we haven't seen yet. Not counting the Dothraki. The Dothraki are people of color, but they're not African looking. This man looks African or Caribbean. And his name is Salador, right? And I'm thinking, the only black character on the show, and you got to name him Salador.
Yeah, I know. You were playing
with that name. I don't know how that's racist, but it has to be.
One of your other friends called it something, too.
My other friend said he thought it was Cellar Door.
Cellar Door.
Oh, so a black man can't be the front door? You've got to keep him down the cellar? So Salador looks to be a charming character.
I thought he was interesting. He's interesting. Because he came across like he has this whole interesting history of conquering most beautiful thing in the world is between a woman's legs. Forget everything else.
Because he wants to get the queen.
He's completely.
Cersei's just going to.
Yeah, he's like this worker bee who wants the queen bee or something.
And he's not going to rape her.
He's completely, yes.
Yeah.
And he's a complete like atheist. He's like, he's not into any of that mumbo jumbo.
Yeah, forget the mumbo jumbo.
The only thing in the world that's worth worshiping is between a woman's legs.
He's got his priorities set.
Right.
And I heard on Bald Move, one of the Bald Move guys referenced us. He saw on Reddit that people are saying that Salador is, he's like Lando Calrissian and Han Solo compressed into one person. he's a space pirate with all the smooth moves and he's a ladies man. You know, it's like one guy.
That's if Lando a good and call. Han are good one call. Guy.
Yeah. So we're looking for a little Colt 45 action maybe. See, it leads you to these things when you only have the one black character. It's like again with T-Dog on Walking Dead. He doesn't get any lines. I
want to
make sure that Salador gets in a lot of the lines. You know, so Salador he's offering. They're asking him to provide his pirate fleet for the attacking King's Landing. This is the Baratheons now, and the guy says, "Look, you know, you can spend the whole rest of your life, which is you're about halfway through your life. You want to spend the next 30 years stealing tea and biscuits from little ships, or do you want to go plunder the richest city in the whole world and take whatever you want? You know, that's the offer. They're offering him as much as you can pack your ships with, you're going to be able to sail off with. You know, and that's for a pirate, that's a pretty good deal. So I think we're going to be seeing a lot out of Salador. And then after that, we have the prayer discussion. Now, the theology on this show is getting interesting. So we have Melisandre. She's like the monotheist. The Lord of Light is her god. And that's, once you pray to him, you don't need ships. You don't need soldiers. You don't need, everybody else is a polytheist. They believe in these like seven gods, right? Basically. And then the Baratheon guy, helper guys are going off after the talking to Salador, and the son is like, well, I prayed for you every day that you were gone. And the father's like, look, my only god is Stannis Baratheon. He's the guy who's made my entire life possible. So I don't go worshiping all these abstract things. You know, this guy's illiterate too. He's like, I can't read. I'm not interested in religion. And I'm only going to be offering any praise to somebody who puts food on my table or protects my family or gives me an opportunity to be realized. And so we're really seeing kind of the rise of religion here. And then later on, so Melisandre comes up to Stannis. And this seems a little bit, strangely off-putting too. He's like planning the war. And then she like just takes off her clothes and kind of throws herself at him, and they go at it on this table.
She's like pure evil,
pure crazy. Yeah, I'd say religious fanatic kind of evil.
Well, I think religious fanatics are.
Yeah, but I mean that's the variety of evil. I'd say and
she wants people to do things that are completely. They only give her some temporary power, and they do absolutely nothing good for the culture, for that individual. They further no cause because it's all this made up bullshit.
Yeah, and then
people are she's going to go down in flames.
What is not clear, and listening to the other podcasts, it's pretty clear it's not clear to other people as well, and like the onlines don't have a real answer for this. Among people who haven't read the books, I assume there's some answer in the books for this stuff, is how much of Stannis really believe in this stuff? Is he believing that some unseen god is going to give him the power to invade a city? Or does he think that Melisandre is going to be useful for morale? Or is he just being seduced against his better judgment? It's really difficult to tell where his mind is around this war that he's launching. Because she's telling him he doesn't even need troops or anything. That he can just roll up and God is going to make him victorious. And his advisors are like, it's like that joke in it was Woody Allen's film, The Crimes and Misdemeanors, where it says they're talking about the boxer. And somebody asks a priest to pray for a boxer. And the priest says, I will, but if he can punch, it'll help. that's what this kind of feels like. It's like, well, it'll help if you have a fleet, And then they're banging away on this table, on this like D&D envy table. It looks
and the little toys are falling down. The pieces are falling down. I think it's exactly.
Total symbol.
Yeah, it's totally foreshadowing of what she's going
to
do.
Yeah, she's undermining his ability to win this war.
She's undermining a lot of people.
Yeah. That table, by the way, looks like Sam Crow is playing Warcraft.
Sons of Monarchy.
Sons of Monarchy is what we're calling this show. Let's see. So then we have the scene with Tyrion and Cersei where she says, you killed her mother, and he says she was my mother too. And the little point that comes out in this that people who have read the books are being very coy about is that everybody kind of believed that the queen, that Cersei, ordered the slaughter of the bastards. And she denies it and claims it was Joffrey. Right. And it's no, and we don't have clarity on that yet over which of the two of them ordered this killing. But basically Tyrion is saying to her, we can't be the baby killers when winter comes and people are starving. You're throwing people out of the city so they can live in the fields, and they're going to look at the baby killers in charge of all of the food, and they're going to come right at us. And then she makes it personal about, well, you killed our mother. And it's like, this is Cersei's downfall. She takes everything so personally and makes everything so small that needs to be big. Right. So it's like she doesn't see the big picture and thinks that as long as she exerts her personal authority, things are going to be fine. And everyone around her is telling her it's not going to work. You can cut my throat, but it's still not going to work. You know, so I think we're going to see her downfall is going to be pretty hard. So, and then the last thing we have is back at Camp Big Love, we see a birth of a son come out of the, and we see.
Oh, wait a minute. We wanted to talk about Tyrion's love interest.
Oh, Shay. Yeah, yeah.
Because you were saying, when you listen to some of the other podcasts, that people are not exactly complimentary.
Oh, right. Yeah. So, no, this is...
And I personally really like her.
I wanted to throw a special shout out. We didn't get much for in this episode, but you're right. I did mention that I wanted to shout out to this thing that I really like Shay. Mm-hmm. I like her accent. Apparently, the actress is from Romania or something like that.
Yeah, so she sounds Slavic.
But she's not faking the accent. Right. She might be pushing it, but she's not faking it. And there's just this sense that she's not, apparently either not in the book or not the same character from the book. And what is she doing here and blah, blah, blah. And I think, as a character, she's totally vile. She softens Tyrion in a way. Otherwise, he would just be another insufferable little prick. And we're really starting to get to like him, you know, because we're seeing somebody who can see him. You know, if he doesn't have anybody who can see into him, if there's nobody who's got his number, then he becomes this opaque shadow. And she can see his number. And also, she's so friendly to him. And she likes everything he likes, you know. So as a character, I love her. But I'm thinking the actress is doing a great job, too. So.
I think she's a great character. She seems really kind of honest.
Yeah.
And she's got her own trip. She lets you know how she feels and thinks. I mean, talk about, you know, she's a really interesting counterweight to him.
And she can keep up with him. Nobody else can keep up with him.
Exactly. And he's like... He kind of trottles off her like a little bit like a puppy. And then sometimes he's a little vexed. And sometimes he's like into it. Like, you know, he's just like, he's a little worn out.
And she's made him a much more pleasant character.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
When he was just calling up.
She's the bad one. And he's now gets to his better angels, as they say, or higher self comes out around her a little
but
bit.
But when he was running through four or five prostitutes in a week, he wasn't as pleasant.
Jerk.
He just seemed like a jerk. And here he seems more. You know, so I'm totally.
He's got a tiger by the tail that's kind of interesting.
I like Shay with Tyrion. I think they're a good couple. And I like the performance as well for the character.
Yes, very much so.
So I want to lend some support to that because it's been getting some criticism. And so the last thing is, so Jon Snow, basically, he witnesses a male son of the Camp Big Love being left out, evidently at first to be exposed, right? But then what looks like, this is another thing where people aren't entirely clear, but it looks
like
a White Walker, right? Which are these monsters that live up in the north. And nobody's quite clear what they are, right? But the theory is that...
Something takes the baby.
Takes the baby. And so the question is the baby taken for food? Which seems like it would be not a lot of food, you know, or is the baby... Or do White Walkers kidnap humans and that's how they reproduce? It's like they don't mate, they kidnap. And this is where White Walkers come from, is kidnapping babies. And kidnapping babies seems like a very sort of Grimm's fairy tale. Kind of thing, and this is a very Grimm's fairy tale monster.
Yes.
So, and then right before, so Jon Snow has just witnessed this, and then he looks up and he gets clubbed over the head, and we snap to black, and that's Game of Thrones. You know, for one more year. So,
couple more days, we get to watch some more.
And so that's pretty much it for our Nattercast for these two shows. I think we're going to try to keep covering both shows because they're...
I think putting them together is good.
It's good because there's
I'm going to start looking at some of the strange matching up between the two. Why I'm sometimes confused. Because I'm sitting here thinking and listening to us talk about this, particularly you, and I'm going, I thought that was in that show. Because the shows really are similar in some ways.
They're so similar, yeah.
Like, we just had poisonings.
We have poisonings.
We had the one... the
cardinal,
and then the witch,
and then the witch, yes. Right?
Little poisoning scenes. I mean, it just the
incest. We have transgendered young people.
Yeah.
You know?
We have two young girls pretending to be boys.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And
then, of course, the incest.
We have multiple kings fighting each
multiple
other.
Multiple kingdoms
cities.
And kings, yes.
Yeah. Incest, yep. You know, and baby stealing.
And people doing really horrible things, like the whole taxidermy dinner.
Right.
And then, you know, the man with his daughter fetish.
And these contemptible characters like Joffrey and Alfonso.
Yes.
You know, who's just completely drip with the desire to see them get killed.
Yes.
You know, so yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
But before we go, we should just say we did see the end of Justified.
Yes, we did.
And
it was very disarming.
And I liked the piggy bank.
You liked the piggy bank on Justified was pretty classic.
I was just like, oh.
Yes. Mr. Limehouse. And his piggy bank.
I'm really becoming more and more fascinated with Mr. Limehouse.
Yeah. Limehouse is great.
Yeah.
And I just started, it's on YouTube, you can find it. I just started watching today, just for because it came up in the news or whatever, the remake they did of Helter Skelter in 2004, starring, I didn't realize that, I just saw it. It's all on YouTube, you can get it on YouTube. Dickie Bennett.
Oh, yeah.
Plays Dickie Bennett, great plays idea. Manson. He's like, perfect. And this, unlike the previous version, this version was more inside the family, so you get to see more of Manson like trying to be a musician, and so there's more meat to the role. He's not just this distant villain. He's the central character. You know, it's not really focused on the lawyers so much. And so, I don't know how accurate it is, but watching Dickie Bennett do the performance, I forget the actor's name, but Dickie Bennett's just hysterical performance.
Oh, yeah, I'll bet. I'm looking forward to seeing that, too.
So, well, I guess... until next week, all I can say is I didn't trade our gasoline for Playmate of the Month. I traded it for Playmate of the Year. It's Apocalypse Now Redux.